Welcome, welcome everyone. My name is Sean, and today we're going to talk about Anna Kasparian of the Young Turks and Cenk Uygur to a lesser extent, saying something reasonable, talking about an outrageous case in New York State, not New York City, which we will get into why that matters a little bit later, and the left-wing outrage craziness over this, while of course they ignore the original point and lie a whole bunch about the whole situation. But before we get into that, I want to thank everybody who signed up over on actualjusticewarrior.com/join.
Give me the money. Okay.
And remind you that on Saturday, April 27th in Austin, Texas, I will be at MindsFest. Link to tickets in the top of the description. And if you use promo code AJW, you get 20% off those tickets. So a couple of days ago, I posted this clip of Anna Kasparian and Cenk Uygur talking about a vicious crime in Long Island where four people were arrested for dismembering two corpses, two murder victims. And because of state bail reform law, New York was unable to remand these individuals to custody. And I talked about how Governor Kathy Hochul was on The View of all places, and Joy Behar was pressing her on this issue, and she said, listen, that's not a violent crime. Dismembering the corpses of two murder victims is no big deal, and maybe in the future session we might change that law.
But there was just a crime in Long Island where body parts were found all over Long Island. They had four suspects. They let them go,
right.
Now they're out there still. So what is the deal here?
Right.
Sounds insane to me.
Though the crime that was brought was not what was bail eligible. Yes, murder is. Yes, conspiracy to commit murder is. Yes, assault is bail eligible. All those are. I know that the DA is working really hard with the Suffolk County Police Department to build the case they need to bring the charges that are necessary. The charges he brought, he did not have enough evidence at the time to hold them.
You can't hold them?
Not on the charges he brought.
Dismembering a corpse and hiding a corpse after dismembering it, not bail eligible, not a serious crime. I'm not even kidding, guys. Like, when Joy Behar outlined that case, I was like, she's crazy. This isn't a thing. This isn't real. So I looked it up. It's real, guys. It's real. Listen, if being on the left means supporting this, then I'm not on the left, and I'm okay with that.
Now, of course, I shared this because Anna and Cenk had sensible reactions to this, and a bunch of dorky, dopey lefties started whining about it, saying copaganda, which, by the way, if you're too lazy to say police propaganda, you should not be taken seriously at all whatsoever. And, of course, they smeared her, they attacked her, and never actually addressed the merits of the case. They were too lazy to look into that, and then decided that Anna was secretly moving to the right wing, and in reality, the fact that I posted this clip as somebody who is on the right, therefore, means by the transitive property, Anna's right wing, because, you know, it's right wing to not want four people who are involved in the covering up minimum of this double murder to be held, or even the judge to have the ability to decide whether or not they will be held pre-trial based on the disgusting nature of this crime and the violent nature of this crime.
So four people were arrested in New York after body parts were found in Long Island. Okay, dismembered body parts. The victims were, two people from Yonkers, older individuals. Suffolk County police say 44-year-old Stephen Brown, 38-year-old Jeffrey Mackey, 40-year-old Amanda Wallace, and 33-year-old Alexis Nieves, were charged with concealment of a corpse, tampering with physical evidence, and hindering prosecution. They have not been charged with murder. Prosecutors told a judge, there was so much blood in pipes, sink, shower, and toilet of the Railroad Avenue home in Amityville where the suspects were arrested that it was deemed uninhabitable. Police said they confiscated meat cleavers, butcher knives, flesh, and body parts. Did further research because I just couldn't believe it. Here's more. With 2019 state reforms, mutilation and disposal of murdered corpses are among crimes that are no longer bail eligible. The DA said the four went to barbaric lengths to cover the crime. What are we doing, Cenk?
Right now, this is Anna's Twitter account. Let's look at what her first retweet is. Here's her retweeting the actual justice warrior, saying that a lot of people in America, yes, that includes on the left, feel exactly like Anna Kasparian in this mega rant. How does it make sense that you have the National Guard searching old ladies in the subway, but the four arrested for dismembering two people get released automatically without a bail? So obviously Sean is saying here that, of course, lots of people agree with Anna, even people on the left. But seemingly she can't find anyone that's actually on the left to retweet who supports her. She has to consistently, retweet people like an actual justice warrior and go on right-wing shows now in order to find any sort of agreement or affirmation that's not from her own co-host. It's so obvious what's happening, guys.
So obviously, of course, when I tweet out that, yeah, even people on the left aren't dumb enough to bite the bullet and say that the group of four people out in Long Island who chopped up the bodies of a couple in their 50s and hid them and stashed them around their house and clogged the drains so much that the house has actually been deemed unlivable should be released without any discretion or input from a judge because he has no ability to hold them under bail reform, there's no way they would side with that. And of course, they decide to come up and say, well, how do you speak for the left? Of course we would side with that. Because, you know, anytime there's a stupid opinion that's out there, these are the kind of people who will jump right on that stupid opinion and then start defending it. However, I do want to give one caveat. Even though they're doing a story about this, even though they set up a stream, even though this is the thing that they're talking about, they don't actually know any of the details of the case. They keep referencing Sheldon Johnson, the guy who was on Joe Rogan, a guy who, by the way, was a criminal justice reform advocate and never took any responsibility for his crimes. We covered that appearance on Rogan where we talked about how he pretended like he accidentally stumbled into being the leader of the Bloods gang.
I was Blood. I was a gang member. This is where the cut comes from on my face. I have a bunch of stab marks from just being in those environments and being on Rikers Island and just warring with other rival gangs, mostly Latin Kings and Inyetas. And I would just stand there, and eventually I just slowly moved up the ranks, and I became this person that I feel like I was never meant to be. But because of the conditions and because of where I was at and because of what I saw, what I was exposed to, made me into someone else.
And he also killed and dismembered people, but he was arrested, charged with murder right away. Completely different circumstance, not what we're talking about. But the point is, they were too lazy to actually look into that, despite being prodded by their super chatters about the particular case, by the way, from their left-wing audience, saying that, yes, those people should have been held, or at least, again, bare minimum, the judge should have been able to have judgment to decide whether or not to hold those people.
And shout out to Kevin, the L.I. Butchers probably shouldn't have been let go, though. I don't know what you're talking about.
The butchers and the dismemberers?
I mean, I don't think that anybody knew. This man had done 20 years of fucking hard time in jail. Like, hard to say that you're supposed to just keep him in there. You know what I mean? Yes, it's a tragedy that he killed people. People in our U.S. and the government kill people all the time. And we don't seem to hold
the
that
cops.
Stand.
Yeah, they're the butchers.
Yeah, literally.
I mean, seriously, guys, listen to this level of commentary. Listen to what the Vanguard is bringing to the table right here. So obviously, they're referencing Sheldon Johnson. It's not about Sheldon Johnson, but they still paint Sheldon Johnson as the victim, the high-level Blood leader, the person who lied and said he got convicted of low-level charges, and that's why he got 50 years, when in reality, he got convicted of attempted murder. And they're like, man, he did hard time. They had to have let him go. What are we even talking about? Not about the video that, again, over the course of 2 days, they didn't watch from Anna Kasparian to actually understand what she said. And then they give you a two wrongs make a who cares. So these guys did some bad things. Well, you know what? The U.S. government did some bad things. So who cares? I mean, why does it matter that these people that butchered an innocent 50-year-old couple disposed of the bodies on the property, the judge doesn't have any discretion on whether or not to release them? Because that's progressive logic. That's sensible. Imagine being these people right here, holding those positions and wondering why people want to distance themselves from you. Being a little bit confused why people would say, you know what, those guys don't make great teammates. These guys seem a little loserish, and if I side with them, I probably would be on the losing side.
This is the kind of video he makes. Looters destroy historic bakery for... Dude, you want to go fucking destroy a historic bakery for fun?
That's
after
badass, dude.
Now, of course, they randomly decide to attack me, and they reminded me, by the way, that I haven't removed my pinned tweet, which was a video put out in January 12th. And they make fun of a case, by the way, that I will link the video in the description of this video, of a street takeover that actually occurred in Compton. And you actually had an intergenerational bakery, a small business owned by a Hispanic family, that they drove a car through, went in, and went out of their way to destroy everything in that bakery. They didn't even necessarily steal a whole bunch of stuff. They destroyed it. And of course, they mock it because, you know, they're for the middle class, therefore the little guy. Struggling business owner, Hispanic origin in Compton, they're like, haha, isn't that funny? And no, it's not funny. That's why I made the video. And it's a fantastic video, you absolute dopes. But this is actually the left-wing worldview of crime. They think that the people who drove the car into that business during a street takeover, they're innocent angel Aladdins, they're victims of society. Earlier on, they said, think about the price of housing in California.
Interpretation. Let's talk about Los Angeles crime and let's talk about crime rates in California. Hey, Cenk, do you know how fucking expensive it is to pay rent in California? Do you know how fucking expensive it is to buy a house? Do you know how expensive it is to eat food? Do you know how expensive it is to put gas in your car?
Because we all know if rent is really high, the thing that you do is go into a business that has been there for 50 years, a small family-owned business, smash your car through it, and destroy everything you can just for the joy of it.
It's funny how that guy's speaking for the left, too. He's like, me, along with many people on the left, I'm sure, agree with this. I'm like,
you look at it, right, and you're like, nobody wants to come out and say that they're a right-winger. Like, if you call somebody a right-winger, they just like hiss and moan and like seethe and cope and that's not true though.
Now, just to show you how lazy these guys are, they go on this whole pointless rant about how I'm on the right but I'm pretending to be on the left because being on the right is so unpopular. To be clear, I'm on the right. I've never once pretended that I was on the left. Never happened in the history of ever. And then they talk about how racist I was in the Sam Cedar conversation related to criminal justice issues.
Remember, he debated Sam Cedar and it was like really racist.
Oh yeah,
despite the fact that again, race didn't come up in that whole conversation. It was never discussed. We were discussing crime, the increase in crime post the Black Lives Matter riots, post George Floyd, post a bunch of criminal justice reforms, and we never got really into the specifics of racial demographics and crime at all.
Anybody that calls himself an actual justice warrior, I'm like, oh, bro, you're so 2010. Oh, God, yeah. Oh, I know everything I need to know now. Okay, you took a suit, a picture of you in a suit at a hotel you stayed at that you thought was fancy. Yeah, I've got a good idea about you, bro. I went to business school with 100 fuckers just like you.
Also, for some reason, they decided that they were going to be mad at my profile photo because I was wearing an expensive suit in a hotel room, and that's what their guys in business school are all about. They knew a million guys just like me. And wouldn't you know it, that completely made up nonsense that they attributed to me that stuck in their own head is completely made up nonsense that they attributed to me that was stuck in their own head. Now, just to tell you how off base these dopes actually are, I want to point out that that is the Encore Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. Absolutely lovely hotel. And I actually got a free upgrade to a suite, so I was very happy about that, but the total cost of me staying at that hotel was -$100, and the reason why is because I was broke back then, so what I used to do is combine credit card points and all these different things in order to take my then-girlfriend and now-fiance on a nice vacation at no cost. So yeah, I'm actually incredibly proud of being able to stay there, being able to pull that off, and actually making money back with the combinations of perks and whatnot that I received. On top of that, the fancy suit that I'm wearing is a $15 shirt from H&M, the cheap sports coat that they have, and some cheap pants. What we were actually doing was going down to one of the restaurants in that hotel because I had a credit, again, from my credit card days, and that actually gave us basically a free meal. So essentially, what these guys are mad about is that I was an extreme couponer, basically the equivalent of that for travel back in the day, and that's really upsetting them.
Like clockwork, the usual suspects trash me and defend the notion that butchers who literally dismember corpses to cover up a murder should enjoy release with no bail. Absolute lunatics. Here's what's crazy, Gavin. Anna's never heard of a principle before. A lot of people on the left, I'm happy to introduce it to her. I actually, this is a good learning opportunity.
So of course these dopes do a live stream because Anna Kasparian tweeted out their video and made fun of them because she was condemning four people who, again, chopped up and dismembered and tried to dispose of the bodies of two murdered people in their 50s. That's what happened in this particular story. And they're like, look, it's about a principle. It's about our stance. And then they, of course, pivot away from the issue at hand because they didn't even bother to look up the case that she's talking about. So they're incapable of addressing it. And of course, they're cowardly. So they have to deflect off the issue.
I also have this principled notion that your wealth should not define your justice before the law. That your accumulative assets, your ancestral lineage, you know, your ability to come into contact with physical wealth should, you know, make you subject to different penalties, different level of persecution, a different level of subjugation.
So this guy goes off on this whole rant and he tries to defend the premise of bail reform. But the thing is, that's not the issue that Anna Kasparian has. You know, if he actually watched the clip at hand, that's not the issue that I have with this particular program. The issue that we both have is not the fact that you're trying to make people be able to afford afford to get out of jail pre-trial, so that finances aren't the thing that gates them off from being able to have a release. The issue is that in the state of New York, unlike 49 other states in this country, judges don't have judgment. So as a part of bail reform, we require that they assess the finances of the people in the limited circumstances where they set bail, and that way they're not financially gated off from being able to post bond. But on top of that, there's a whole host of categories of crime where, regardless of any circumstances, the judge cannot use his judgment to hold these people, remand them to custody, despite the fact that the judge knows and all of us know that they're a serious ongoing threat to society. So the issue with the four people who chopped up and disposed of two murder victims in a very gruesome way is that the judge had no ability for judgment. In fact, even if he were able to set bail in that particular case, which, by the way, dismembering a corpse does not qualify for being able to set any financial bail, that's also another issue, he would have had to have done what these guys are suggesting, which is look into their finances, look at their ability to pay, and base the bail on that.
Essentially, what I'm saying, Anna, is I oppose a two-tier justice system, one that makes it easier for the rich to stay out of jail, and one that makes it easier to put poor people into jail.
So what they're talking about is not the issue at hand. They're not saying anything about how we shouldn't gate off based on finances that Anna actually disagrees with. What they're actually doing, though, is ignoring the issue at hand, which is, unlike 49 other states and the District of Columbia, in the state of New York, judges don't have the ability to have judgment.
So that's why, even though some people do horrible things, like I think the man that she's referencing is the guy that was on Rogan, right? And he gets out of prison and he's like a reform activist. And, you know, he goes in immediately after that. He like butchers some guy to death in his apartment. Guess what? I'm not pro butchering. Okay. I don't think you should go out there and do homicide, right? It's crazy.
What?
You
know? Like I said earlier in the video, these guys are completely lazy and ill-informed. This stream was actually a full day after they posted the previous video where they were talking about Anna Kasparian, and at no point in time did they decide to actually look into the case that she was referring to, which, spoiler alert, is not the Sheldon Johnson case. It has nothing to do with the guy who ended up killing people after being presented as this reform activist on Joe Rogan's podcast. It's not related at all. The reason nobody talks about that case in regards to bail reform is because this guy was not released due to bail reform. It has no connection. I don't know how to make this any more clear, but these guys were too lazy to look into the Long Island case that Anna Kasparian was referencing, but more importantly, that Governor Kathy Hochul was defending on The View, which is the whole premise of the story, the whole premise of the rant, because why should they be bothered to actually look into the topic that they're talking about when it comes to someone like Anna Kasparian, who they just want to smear?
Yeah, she's also just lying. All violent crime is bail eligible in NYC. And I'm not saying that as an activist. I'm saying that as a criminal attorney in New York City and a national expert on bail reform. 100%.
So they put up a chat from Olay on the screen where she says Anna is lying. All violent crime, all caps, so you know she's dead serious, is bail eligible in the city of New York. And she knows this because she's a New York City attorney and a national expert on New York State bail reform, because that totally makes sense. Now, this is clearly and obviously not true. In fact, I even brought us a handy dandy chart that talks about the updated amended version of bail reform that they put in after the original bail reform, which was significantly worse, which actually guaranteed you a release for the nonviolent crimes of manslaughter in the second degree, aggravated vehicular homicide, criminally negligent homicide, assault in the third degree, aggravated vehicular assault, making a terroristic threat, criminal possession of gun on school grounds / criminal possession of a firearm, criminal sale of a firearm to a minor, arson in the third and fourth degree, promoting or possessing obscene sexual performance by a child, aggravated cruelty to animals, overdriving, torturing, and injuring animals, animal fighting, unlawful imprisonment of the first degree, coercion of the first degree, grand larceny of the first degree. Just look at all these nonviolent crimes that were included in the original bail reform. And by the way, Olay and other activists like her fought back against changing these violent crimes, changing these homicide charges that were eligible for a same-day automatic release according to the original bail reform law. But even this updated version clearly and obviously does not allow bail, but more importantly, the remanding of violent repeat offenders to custody, which is the thing that they need to fix.
Yeah, she's also just lying. All violent crime is bail eligible in NYC. And I'm not saying that as an activist. I'm saying that as a criminal attorney in New York City and a national expert on bail reform. 100%.
So even though they're talking about bail and things being bail eligible, I will remind you that the actual issue that I have and the actual issue that Anna Kasparian has is not the monetary amount that you set for offenders, because yes, that can produce circumstances where somebody who, by the way, is technically legally innocent ends up not being able to post bond, and that's why they end up in jail. The real important category is this one all the way on the far right, which is the judge's ability to remand certain offenders that they believe are serious ongoing threats to society. Because as you can see at the top, even in the instances where they set bail, under bail reform, they're required to assess the ability of the person to pay and then only set a bail that aligns with their ability to pay. Right at the top, you see domestic violence offenses are not even subject to a cash bail system. Now, one of the things that you might notice when you're looking at this chart is there's these little itty bitty red numbers that pop up here and then, and these are actually like asterisks that you should go to at the bottom of this chart so that you can read up more about certain information. Because while you might see a crime like strangulation is technically bail eligible, asterisk number 7 explains that that's actually not really the case. You see, criminal contempt as a misdemeanor and criminal obstruction of breathing or blood circulation are bail eligible only, all caps, if the underlying order of protection is for a family member as defined by the CPL. That's really interesting because this New York City attorney and world-renowned expert on bail reform, nobody has more expertise than her, must have missed the fact that if you strangle somebody, it's not bail eligible unless that person is a family member with an order of protection against you. The nonviolent crime of strangling somebody and obstructing their breathing, don't worry about that. And again, like I said, bail is not the issue. The fact that you're setting a dollar amount doesn't bother me. In fact, I'm fine with lowering it so people can pay in order to get out of jail, because I don't want broke people to not be able to afford to get out of jail. The issue is, beyond that, judges don't have judgment in order to hold these people in custody when they present themselves as a serious ongoing threat to society. They have that ability in 49 other states, not New York State, and that's been an absolute disaster. On top of that, there's another asterisk with an order of protection if we look through this very document. So criminal contempt as a felony and unlawful imprisonment are bail eligible only if the underlying order of protection is for a family member of the defendant as defined by 530.11. So I guess the totally nonviolent crime of false imprisoning somebody that's not bail eligible, again, and the judge cannot remand somebody for doing, is no big deal unless, of course, there's already an established order of protection from a family member. You know, this is perfectly normal. By the way, this is one of the reasons why women's groups are outraged at this, because their stalkers end up getting released over and over again. Very prominently, Taylor Swift's stalker was actually released and rearrested repeatedly because bail reform doesn't allow them to hold people despite them showing this behavior, except under these limited circumstances. And they're very limited. Notice it does not say order of protection in general. It says order of protection from a family member. Hey guys, editing Sean here. So I noticed after shooting this video that there was actually an update to New York State bail reform law circa May 2022, effective January 1st, 2023, that removed the order of protection provision for the domestic violence in terms of strangulation and for the unlawful imprisonment. However, this was the law of the land up until 2023, and Olay did fight against the reforms to the reforms, as did many left-wingers, even for these mild changes. On top of that, if you notice, both provisions still only make these crimes bail eligible if you're strangling or obstructing the breathing of a family member. And the same is true for the unlawful imprisonment.
I'm kind of edgy. I smoke weed sometimes, so I'm hip and cool. But in reality, yeah, she's just a bougie Karen, 100%. Happy to have you on the right, Anna, LOL. Basically no support from the left, by the way. Straight up no support from the left. The other day she was retweeting Actual Justice Warrior. We talked about that super tough on crime loser propagandist right winger. That's all she can do now, and I don't think she's gonna have on Elia Mia Laurent to debate this. obviously not us, but, you know.
Now, look, these guys don't know anything, so I don't think they're actually technically lying. I think that they're just lazy. They didn't look into the actual story that Anna Kasparian was commenting about. They didn't look into her commentary and position on this particular issue, because why be informed when you can clickbait the Young Turks? And by the way, as somebody who's profited more than anybody on this website by making fun of TYT, I understand that. I feel you. Believe me, I used to love going after the Young Turks, and I'm kind of a little bit heartbroken that they're starting to make a little bit more sense now, because how am I going to pay for things if they start making sense? But the thing is, Olay is somebody who should know better. She is an advocate for this, and based on her history of deliberately lying and misrepresenting stuff, I do believe she is lying. Let us not forget that during the whole don't call me a birthing person thing, Olay tweeted out this compilation of Anna Kasparian reading quotes of people saying the N-word, as was common practice back in the day in the news media. And even though each one of those stories was Anna Kasparian and the Young Turks condemning somebody who was white for using the N-word as a racist, Olay decided to caption it with, don't call me a birthing person, but she'll call you the N-word. So here is Olay deliberately lying and weaponizing race in order to go after somebody that she disagrees with politically. And all of these cowardly lefties that know that she did this, that can see this, that know 100% that Anna Kasparian did not call any black person the N-word, that's just not true, don't even talk about that. They ignore it. They pretend like it didn't happen because they're far more interested into sucking up to this person who, of course, will immediately smear you as racist falsely at the drop of the hat when she's losing a political argument. That's who Olay is, though. That's who they're sucking up to. That's who they never call out for this. And by the way, no lefty ever calls her out for this.
But yeah, let's take a look here at this video from Olay where she's clearing up some of the misinformation about bail reform in New York City. And as she says, here's everything you need to know about New York City bail reform as told to you by a New York City criminal attorney. So I think this is about the best possible response for Anna, you know, better than we could say it. So let's take a look.
Now they go on to play Olay's video, which debunks all the myths with 12 facts about bail reform. And I decided rather than go into their stupid commentary related to this, that I'm actually going to go through this point by point by point and show you how dishonest and uninformed Olay is.
Bail reform in New York City is constantly under attack, despite being a resounding success. Every time I turn my head, someone is spreading lies and propaganda about bail reform and trying to link it to a million things that it has nothing to do with.
So first of all, I would expect a world-renowned intergalactic expert on New York State bail reform law to understand that it is in fact New York State bail reform law, not New York City bail reform law. Yet, this world-renowned expert, top tier in her field, ends up saying New York City bail reform over and over and over again, despite the fact that it's a statewide law. It's New York State, Olay. You're an attorney and world-renowned expert. You should know the difference. And what I find funniest about this particular video is that she says people keep trying to tie bail reform to things that have nothing to do with it.
And trying to link it to a million things that it has nothing to do with.
And then she proceeds to tie bail reform to things that have nothing to do with it.
Under the hopes that the public who doesn't know better will accept it. So here are 12 facts about New York City's bail reform so you can understand the issue. First, why do we have bail reform? Rikers. Rikers is New York City's infamous pretrial detention center. Everyone has heard about Rikers, but less people realize that it's a pretrial detention center. More than 85% of the people there are awaiting trial. They have not been convicted of a crime. They simply do not have the money to pay their bail and afford their freedom.
So she says, again, in her 12 facts video, that in her opinion, New York State bail reform is passed based on Rikers. Again, this is the dumbest thing I've heard. And she talks about it as a pretrial detention center. It's a jail, just so you guys understand. And yes, jail holds people convicted of misdemeanors, and it also holds people while they're awaiting trial for a variety of circumstances. And by the way, a lot of the people being held pre-trial in Rikers Island as a jail, even post-bail reform, are being held for serious charges that they're still eligible to be held for. So yeah, it's a serious place. It also has probation and parole violations. So the idea that people are being held there without any convictions is not true. Some of the people that are being held pre-trial on new pending cases actually have previous convictions. That's why you would hold somebody based on a recent criminal history. But then she goes on to say that Rikers Island is actually racist.
And in this city where 42% of the people identify as white, more than 90% of everyone awaiting trial at Rikers is either black, brown, or Hispanic.
So I know you guys at home are still waiting for Ole to make her point, but I assure you that that was actually the point that she was trying to make. She said in a city where 42% of the population identify as white, whatever that means, 90% of the people in Rikers Island awaiting trial are black or Hispanic. And this should be surprising to no one because blacks and Hispanics commit way more crimes than white people. I mean, again, pull up the shooting stats, whatever stats for any given year, and what you'll find out is that 90+% of the suspects are black or Hispanic for shootings, extraordinarily high for murder, extraordinarily high percentages for rape. Anybody can look at any of these stats. They'll be fully linked in the description. So the idea that you compare the general population groups in terms of their size in the overall population instead of the crime rates among the groups makes no sense at all. I mean, think about it like this. New York City has the largest Jewish population outside of Israel. 1/8 of the city, I believe, is Jewish. That's over 1 million people. Jewish people commit way less crimes than average ordinary white people in New York City. So we wouldn't expect to see a perfect representation of Jewish people as compared to white people in New York City because white people commit more crimes. Same thing with Asians. The reason why the Asian population isn't represented according to their pie chart of population in New York City jails is because Asians don't commit crimes. This is the behavior, Ole. You haven't made a point yet.
This was 35-year-old Jose Martinez. He was given a parole violation after being accused of stealing a single can of beer. And they sent him to Rikers where he died in a cell when the guards refused to help him.
So Ole says, okay, Jose Martinez, this guy right here, he got a parole violation for stealing a single can of beer. And by the way, this is why we have bail reform, because he died when the guards refused to help him. Now you are going to be absolutely shocked, stunned that this world-renowned expert on New York State bail reform and New York City attorney is completely wrong about everything that she just said about Jose Martinez. Like, every single fact she's wrong about. In fact, I would double check the age of him. That's how off she is. So first of all, Jose Mejia Martinez didn't steal one can of beer. He was actually arrested for stealing two cases of beer from a C-Town supermarket in Harlem. On top of that, during his arrest, cops found a crack pipe in his pocket, and he was charged with criminal possession of a controlled substance in the 7th degree, which is incredibly low. Now, Mejia was also given two separate desk appearances on pending cases while he was on parole, and he had also been cited by his parole officer multiple different times prior to this for not meeting with the parole officer and following the conditions of that parole. Now, considering he was on parole for a violent crime, that being assault, you would think these repeated violations and rearrest based on his criminal history would have had a warrant issued to send him back to prison a long time ago, but they didn't up until this point in time. It was a pattern of behavior from Mejia Martinez that ended up sending him back to Rikers. And by the way, in Rikers Island, he ended up dying of a drug overdose, and it is alleged that it took the guards 10 minutes to get to him after his cellmate began warning them about this particular situation. Now, by the way, if there is any fault of the Rikers Island guards, they should be punished for their actions. These people are under the care of your custody, and just because they snuck drugs in or they got drugs while in the jail and then they ended up taking it does not mean that you should be derelict in your duty and not resuscitate these individuals. But the point is, everything that this woman just said about this case is absolutely objectively false. Even the fact that this has anything to do with bail reform is false, because this led to the passage of a law called Less is More, which we talked about on this particular channel, which heavily restricts the instances where people can have their probation or parole violated to be sent back to jail or prison to finish out their sentences. But for some reason, the intergalactic expert on New York State bail reform seems to not realize that without Less is More, even with the most broad application of bail reform, the original form that it was passed, his parole or probation could have still been violated and the outcome would have been exactly the same. This is a less is more case. Anybody who looks up Jose Martinez in this particular case, it will be talked about in conjunction with less is more because it has nothing to do with bail reform.
I'm trying to link it to a million things that it has nothing to do with.
Now, since Ole wanted to bring up less is more and thinks an anecdote is somehow the broad basis for statewide policy, let's talk about Christian Valdez. We actually did a whole video on him. In 2017, Christian Valdez attempted to murder a single mother and her 4-year-old daughter. He was stabbing them while they were trapped on a fire escape.
I just remember what happened.
The sixth grader was only 4 at the time, but the ordeal left her with mental and physical scars. Over the weekend, the girl and her mother saw Valdez on the news. The 30-year-old ex-con allegedly threw a romantic partner onto subway tracks as a train pulled in. Both of the victim's legs are now amputated.
Now, it's important for you guys to understand, even though Christian Valdez attempted to murder this woman and her then 4-year-old daughter, he ultimately ended up being convicted of an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, likely due to a plea bargain, which is the result of the majority of cases. And in December of 2023, Christian Valdez was paroled. Days later, Christian Valdez attempted to murder his ex-girlfriend in December of 2023. Now, to be clear, attempted murder is something that is a bail-eligible offense, no doubt about it. However, according to New York State bail reform law, judges, unlike in 49 other states, are not allowed to use dangerousness as a proxy for determining bail or whether or not they will hold somebody pre-trial. And in fact, they're actually obligated by law to use the least restrictive conditions. And when we go to number 5 in the asterisk, even if they were to set a bail, they have to set a bail that they know that the defendant can afford. So yes, even though this was bail eligible, because of bail reform, he was released, despite the fact that he has now attempted to murder 3 different individuals. But that's okay, because he's on parole, and obviously this should be an instance where you violate somebody's parole. He attempted to kill his ex-girlfriend. This is a dangerous individual who just got out of prison on a violent crime where he attempted to kill a mother and her daughter, so no-brainer, violate his parole. But then less is more kicks in, which makes it extraordinarily difficult to violate somebody's parole, so he was released. And in March of this year, just a week or two ago,
30-year-old ex-con allegedly threw a romantic partner onto subway tracks as a train pulled in. Both of the victim's legs are now amputated.
Christian Valdez was arrested because he shoved his current girlfriend onto the train tracks, another instance of attempted murder, and because the train came by, both her legs were severed in this particular instant.
Do not let him come out. Do not let him come out, because he's going to keep doing it.
Velez allegedly did this while on parole for stabbing the Aquinos. Not to mention, Valdez is accused of trying to murder an ex-girlfriend last December, days after being released from prison. 2 violent crimes in which parole was allegedly violated.
So when I talk about the issues with bail reform, when I talk about the issues with criminal justice reform, this is what I'm talking about. The violent repeat offenders that keep getting breaks because judges in the state of New York don't have judgments. You want to trade every single non-violent first-time offender or whatever and not allow judges to set bail for those people that they can't afford so that they can be released pre-trial? Totally on board with it. And dare I say it, Anna Kasparian probably on board with it, because those people aren't the issue. But we have to trade that for judges having judgment for these very repeat offenders.
More than a dozen New Yorkers meet the same fate each year. In fact, since Eric Adams became mayor, more than 30 people have died awaiting trial at Rikers.
So Alay says this many people died in Rikers Island awaiting trial, and honestly, without any comparisons, we have no idea at all whatsoever if it's a lot. Remember, Rikers Island is the jail for New York City, the largest city in the United States of America. 5 counties, which are called boroughs, are a part of New York City, so the raw number of deaths is absolutely meaningless in comparison to the rest of the country, because no country has a jail that's meant to service this many people by comparison. Not to mention, if you have an instance where somebody overdoses, that's not really a death due to the abuses of the guards or anything like that. Prisoners get violent with each other, they have drug addiction problems, they have health problems, and again, the conditions of this particular jail have nothing to do with bail reform at all whatsoever. Let's say we actually shut down Rikers Island. Let's say we actually implement something that Bill de Blasio was pushing for early in his administration, which is have 5 separate jails for each of the boroughs of New York City, which, by the way, I actually thought was a pretty good idea, because having people be able to more easily visit their family members while they're in jail ends up establishing better connections with the outside, which ends up reducing recidivism. That would address the issues at Rikers Island without doing bail reform. So why is she pretending that bail reform has anything to do with Rikers Island? Oh, wait, she doesn't know anything about it, despite her interdimensional expertise on New York State bail reform.
2. Before bail reform passed, Black New Yorkers were more than twice as likely as white New Yorkers to spend at least a night in Rikers because they were unable to afford bail.
Yeah, Black New Yorkers commit way more crimes and disproportionately more violent crimes than white New Yorkers. So, I mean, I don't know what the issue is with that. You haven't said anything.
3. Bail reform took effect in New York City 4 years ago in 2020. Bail reform made it so most misdemeanors, excluding sex offenses and domestic violence, some nonviolent felonies, traffic offenses, and violations became bail ineligible.
So Alay puts up this article right here, and it might be a little bit difficult for you to notice under her text-to-speech thing that she's doing for TikTok, but even right there, it says almost all violent felonies. And by the way, we just showed you the chart of all the different ones where it's not eligible, but more importantly, it's not about the monetary amount assessed for bail. I actually agree. We shouldn't money gate people that we don't think are a threat from being able to be released. It's about the fact that in New York State, judges don't have judgment. And because of that, you have repeat offenders being released. And again, she brings up original bail reform and talks about how that was mostly misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. But that's not true. Now, while it is true when originally passed, the most serious violent felonies were technically bail eligible, in reality, there were plenty of violent crimes that were not. Drunken driving accidents that resulted in the death of other people were not bail eligible. You were guaranteed release. Aggravated vehicular assault. And one of my favorites is the fact that they couldn't use your previous criminal history, nor could they use any combination of the crimes, nor how many times you committed the crimes in order to hold you pre-trial. Because again, in New York State, judges don't have judgment, and they can't use bail any longer as a proxy for that judgment, because they had to assess when those circumstances arose that you could set bail, what the amount was based on the income of the person that they were dealing with. So we had a crazy scenario initially where making a terroristic threat, like, you know, saying that you're going to go shoot up a school, and possession of a firearm at said school were not bail eligible on their own. And of course, you couldn't combine these two offenses to make them bail eligible. So that person, if they were arrested entering the school on the cusp of committing that shooting and didn't actually shoot anybody, would be released automatically and no judgment from the judge. This was actually a loophole that they had to close after the fact. And as we talked about with domestic violence, even with the amendments, even with it updated, that only applies if it's a family member. So no, that's not true, Olay. You're lying. You don't know what you're talking about because you're a propagandist for this crappy law that you don't even understand is a state law.
Unless there was some evidence, like a bench warrant history or previous failures to appear, that a person would not return to court. Because four, the legal purpose of bail is to ensure that a person returns to court.
Now, again, while it is technically true that you could assess a bail under the amended version of bail reform for bail jumping, you still cannot remand somebody to custody based on the fact that they are fleeing, escaping, and not trying to show up in court.
And since bail reform was implemented, more people are returning to court than ever before. The failure to appear rate fell from 15% in 2019 to 9% in 2021 after bail reform. Data shows that the vast majority of people show up to their court dates in New York City.
So Alay brings up that in New York City, the rate of people showing up to their court dates fell from 15% to 9% post-bail reform, comparing 2021 to 2019. Now, there could be a number of reasons for this. First and foremost, the institution of virtual court dates, but also the fact that a lot more charges in Manhattan and in the Bronx are being downgraded and dismissed for people who normally wouldn't show up to their court dates. Alvin Bragg is dismissed more cases than any of his predecessors at an alarming rate. But regardless of that, the majority of people showed up to court before bail reform, and the majority have showed up after bail reform. And even though it's slightly up in New York State as a whole, it is down according to this metric in New York City. And that's a good thing. There can be good things about laws that they pass, even if there are other things that need to be changed.
Five. This myth that people are getting released without bail and committing crime after crime after crime and there's nothing that the court can do about it because of bail reform is exactly that, a myth. The conditions of release on absolutely any charge in New York City is that if you commit a crime and are rearrested, the judge can and likely will set bail on you. And that is even the case for every bail eligible case I mentioned earlier. Six. The number of major felonies in 2020, the year bail reform went into effect, was lower than every year from 2000 to 2019.
So I love the fact that Olay decided that she was going to go with this. She says, look, in 2020, the serious violent felonies, they were lower than in any other year from 2000 to 2019 after bail reform took effect. But the thing is, that's not true. Overall crime reports were down by 681 reports. But in the major categories, you know, that people care about, they were up significantly. So murder is one that's kind of important, jumped 47% the year bail reform was implemented. The largest year-over-year increase in the history of the city of New York. We went from 319 murders in 2019, again, a low point in the city's history, to over 450 murders. New York police say that yes, technically they had a historic low in the overall crime index, but there were significant upticks in homicides, shootings, burglaries, car thefts in the calendar year of 2020. And you can see specifically, shootings were up 97%. According to this report, murders were up 44%. So yeah, I don't know what Olay is counting as serious violent felonies, but it looks like to me that you had some drop off in the statistics. Maybe that had to do with something like the pandemic, less officers on the beat, less people reporting crimes, less people going to offices and whatnot. But in the serious crimes, murder, shootings, robberies, and whatnot, they show significant increases.
The number of major felonies in 2020, the year bail reform went into effect, was lower than every year from 2000 to 2019.
So no, you're wrong. Thanks for playing. And thanks for trying to play down all these different homicides that happened post bail reform, which, by the way, we still have not recovered from the effect of these policies and the George Floyd effect.
More importantly is number 7. Since bail reform was enacted, according to the Brennan Center, rearrests for alleged violent felonies have remained exceptionally rare, just as it was exceptionally rare even prior to bail reform.
So Olay's pulling a little bit of a fast one right here for you, where she says, listen, just like before bail reform, people being rearrested for violent felonies is exceptionally rare. But the thing is, the issue that I have, that Anna has, is the fact that those exceptionally rare criminals, the ones that are outsized represented in the number of crimes that they committed, they're the ones catching the breaks. In fact, if you go back to the original segment, one of the things that Joy Behar brought up to Governor Kathy Hochul.
Talk to you for a second, because the CEO of the MTA says that 1% of subway suspects are responsible for more than 20% of the crime because of New York's bail reform laws, which allows them to go back out there and commit more crime.
Is that just 1% of the criminals in the transit system are responsible for 20% of the violent crimes in that very same system, but they keep getting released for bail reform? So what Olay's trying to do right here is expand the denominator. Since the overwhelming majority of people who are arrested, it's a one-time thing or a low-level thing, and they're unlikely to reoffend, she's using that to obfuscate the fact that we've seen dramatic increases in those very same repeat offenders, in those very same violent felons. This is the same exact trick that the Data for Collaborative Justice did when they studied bail reform, which was front-load their articles about this with the low-level misdemeanors and the drop in recidivism for them, while obfuscating the dramatic increases in these violent repeat offenders that, again, in a state where judges had judgment, they would be yanked off the streets. So I will link the study in full in the description of this video so any of you can check it out. But as you can see, based on this website that, again, advocates for bail reform, they're front-loading with the information related to misdemeanors and trying to sell you on the fact that overall the recidivism is down. But even that is a little bit sketchy for people like Olay to talk about, because they mention the fact that because of the reforms to bail reform, the tightening it up because it was so broad when initially passed, have resulted in reductions in recidivism that would otherwise be higher absent those reductions. But more importantly is the issue of this subgroup of people that we're talking about, which are the violent repeat offenders. So what you find out is that these people who have recent criminal histories at the time that they were arrested and released due to the new bail reform policies, they're getting arrested 66% of the time. Two-thirds of the time, they're getting arrested, and that's over the course of a two-year period. But when it comes to violent felons, it's actually even worse. So this same study shows that 67% of defendants who had a recent prior violent felony arrest in the past year, not in the past 2 years, were rearrested within 2 years of their arraignment. Almost half of those, 49%, were rearrested for a felony. So what this study shows, that again, the headlines say bail reform is a resounding success, is that those exact repeat offenders that we're worried about, that core group of criminals that commit disproportionately high amounts of crime, are reoffending over and over and over again, which should surprise nobody, because a lot of the systems of our criminal justice system are set up to address those people, and now New York is pretending that they don't exist, but they're not allowing you to pretend that they don't exist. Now, there's a Manhattan Institute study from August of 2022, just so you guys know, that says that the rearrest rates for those with prior charges of larceny, burglary, or robbery are around 70%, and they say that this is during the period of time while their case is pending. But to be clear, the Manhattan Institute is a right-wing organization, but the other numbers that I cited that come from the DCJ is a left-wing institution that is pro-bail reform. That's why the framing of their numbers is so off, and you actually have to dig into the study to talk about those repeat offenders that I'm interested in discussing and addressing, because they're the problem. Again, I don't want people who are one-time offenders that are going to straighten out their lives to rot in jail because they can't afford bail. Almost nobody is in favor of that. But what I do want is these people who show a pattern of behavior, a propensity to reoffend, to not get a same-day automatic release for their crimes, to not be allowed to escalate their criminality to the point where they kill someone. And again, even though I have this crazy reputation as being right-wing and tough on crime for no reason, I've always said that I want to be smart on crime. So if we got better recidivism rates for low-level offenses with bail reform, then we should keep the aspects of bail reform that work while addressing the problems, instead of denying the problems and trying to inflate the statistical group in order to obfuscate them. Now, you guys also need to understand that these rearrest rates for these people with recent violent histories, recent felony convictions, and whatnot is actually understating the problem, because all they're saying is that if at any point in time within the 2 years, are they being arrested and are they being arrested for a felony? What they're not telling you is how many times they're being rearrested. So it's an individual. If they get rearrested once or 100 times, then they count just the same. So we don't actually have a good grasp of this problem. And considering the MTA issue, where 1% of the criminal population represents 20% of the total arrests in terms of assaulting transit workers and all sorts of problems, we also have the 327 people that represent over 6,000 arrests. That's a third of the arrests for retail theft in New York City, and on and on and on in terms of all these different subgroups of crime. Not to mention, arrests are not a good proxy for measuring crime, which is why we don't measure crime in arrests, but we're measuring recidivism in arrests in this context, because this is what we do when we have limited data. So a great example of this is the fact that arrests outside of New York City, so we're talking about New York State minus New York City, were 184,000 in 2019 compared to 154,000 in 2022. However, even though arrests were reduced by 30,000, in fact, there were 17,000 more reported crimes in 2022 than in 2019. So even though this pro-bail reform organization inadvertently showed us that yes, violent repeat offenders are repeat offending and benefiting off of bail reform, that's allowing them to do so, it doesn't tell us how many times they're being rearrested, and it doesn't take into account the fact that there's a bunch of crimes that these people are in fact committing that they're not being arrested for, because as crime is going up in New York State as a whole, arrest rates are actually dropping. So again, to the progressive left, to these guys over at the Vanguard, I don't care at all whatsoever if another cent is charged to determine whether or not somebody is released or not released. My concern is not this section right here, the bail eligible section. My concern is the section to the right of it, whether or not a judge can use judgment in order to hold these violent repeat offenders, this low percentage, even according to Olay, of predators that constantly re-offend. These people that she doesn't want to talk about, she wants to hide. And to go back to our point, the original thing that set Anna Kasparian off, these four people who covered up the murder of two different people likely will be charged with murder, and the fact that the judge cannot hold them, despite the fact that we know one or all of them is going to be charged with murder going forward. You can't have judgment, and we've already started to see individuals from this group get rearrested for additional crimes.
Yeah, come at me right now and tell me I'm the bad guy, because I want these people who dismembered corpses and tried to conceal the evidence in prison. Come at me and tell me I'm the bad guy. Come at me.
The reason why people are resorting to theft, the reason why people are, committing crimes, is because they're not able to have their basic needs met.
I don't, guys.
Insane. insane. You guys are insane. Anyone who thinks this is okay is insane. And everyone else in New York has to suffer the consequences of this.
So again, the issue is that in the state of New York, judges don't have judgment. Even when they get up to the point where they can issue a bail, they have to scale that bail to what is payable. But in a lot of circumstances, the overwhelming majority of circumstances, they can't remand somebody based on their perceived dangerousness, which is something that they can do in 49 states in the Union and the District of Columbia. DC passed their own version of bail reform in the 1990s, and when there's a problem going on in DC, people don't talk about DC bail reform. They talk about whether or not the judge used his or her judgment appropriately, because they actually have the ability to use judgment in those particular cases. That's what we want. That's what we're addressing. You can try to hide it, obfuscate it, lie about people all you want, but in reality, in actuality, when you face up to the actual heart of the issue, your arguments can't stand up to it. So tell me about how, oh, it's so expensive to have housing in New York City. There's no libraries. That's why people rape.
Ole says, there's no reason to be confused about why crime happens in New York City. New York City is one of the most expensive cities to live in the entire world. And every year, our leaders defund housing, homeless services, education, healthcare, parks, and libraries, which, by the way, has all been like escalated by Eric Adams, all while giving more money to the NYPD. Not like you heard any of that in the Young Turks analysis of what's going on in NYC as it relates to bail reform. But yeah, of course, she's 100% correct. All of these issues can be traced back to this.
Because, oh my God, they're closing the library in the next budget section on Sundays, and therefore people have to become serial rapists in order to feed their starving family, or whatever stupid arguments you want to put forward. But in reality, you guys got nothing. You have no counter to the actual argument being put forward. That's why you have to lie over and over and over again. That's why you can't dig into the issue at all to even know what you're referencing. Anyway, that's all I really have for you guys today. Thank you so much for watching. If you like this video, then show them by leaving a like, subscribe for more content, follow me on my social medias, support me via the support links in the description of this video. This has been me talking about the ridiculous reaction to Anna Kasparian's sensible points. Till next time.